You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
If it's true that the excesses of the wealthy are paid for by those who can least afford it, then the Olympic Games provide a perfect example. The Olympics have provided no help for the most vulnerable in our society, and in fact they've exacerbated the already significant stresses faced by the least fortunate. Our next speaker from the Right to the City Forum argues just this point. Cecily Nicholson is with the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, and she spoke on the challenges facing her organization and those like hers. Here is a recording of her talk from January 25th.
What I'd like to focus on is the ways in which the Olympics has been a catalyst for already advancing forces, very critical concerns for those most marginalized in our society. Some of these things include a dominant nationalism, gentrification, investment, development, aggressive policing, protection of property, surveillance, profiling, control of public conversation and dissent, a rapidly and historically expanding gap in the income levels between the richest and the poorest, access to property and material, legislated poverty, economic migration, the degradation of land and extraction of resources, and sadly it's a list that can keep going. And the communities that are most impacted by the failure of our economic system, and I see the fact that we can allow this Olympic moment to happen as a failure of our economic system and a failure of the state and a failure of us all. This is impacting particular communities more than others. This is impacting particular people more than others. And we know historically that this is overwhelmingly racialized communities. These are poor communities, new immigrants, women, caregivers of children, caregivers of elderly, people contending with illness, people contending with limits to their ability. And it's those people who are experiencing an inordinate impact of the responsibility of this offloading of debt. And I say it's inordinate, it seems so obvious to me, when the cost of the economic factors are one's well-being and one's life, not whether or not your stocks go up and down, whether or not your property values decrease or your rent increase. With people who are actually, it's a matter of life and death, and we are definitely dealing with that in this city. We are seeing a very clear increase in the precarity of working conditions, particularly for those industries most marginalized and constructed as illegal. We see that wages in the so-called legal economy are absolutely not conducive to the cost of living for low-income wage earners. And we see further that the cost of living is clearly increasing. We have a lack of affordable housing. I mean, I don't know how many times and in whatever ways we need to say the fact that it's completely unacceptable that there are thousands of people that are sleeping on the street. And furthermore, that on top of all of this, that there is this criminalization of survival efforts. And I want to point out that when we are talking about a situation of economic crisis, and I do believe that this feels like it for me, and I think the aftermath of the Olympics is going to be devastating, that when we're talking about economic decline, that we, corresponding with this hand in hand, is an increase of violence, all kinds of violence, lateral violence, interpersonal violence, sexual violence, domestic violence, violent crime, and that this also disproportionately impacts particular people and overwhelmingly women. These conditions that I'm talking about, you know, whether it's housing, whether it's you know, issues of violence, whether it's not having enough food, shelter, these all lead to an impact. It impacts the basic health, well-being, and survival. And this is happening at a time when there are increasing barriers to accessing health care and accessing a multitude of care that's necessary to prevent illness and to treat it once we have it. And so in the middle of this, and I say and I speak from an organization that is intended, its intent is to respond to these conditions. And there are many, many organizations throughout the city, the Lower Mainland and beyond in the context of the state whose purpose is to deal with these conditions. But a successful organization in the context of neoliberalism right now is an integrated and inline organization. So that is to say that you are absent from public discourse unless it's a controlled forum or a government consultation or in the context of research reports or perhaps maybe professional gatherings. But for the most part, a general and open forum around these issues is not something that social services certainly and organizations are supposed to be participating in. We are subject to very strict and specific discursive frameworks when we approach funding, when we try to access resources. And they emphasize things like skills, like jobs, development, victim services. And these aren't innocent wording. This isn't something that we fill out the application and it's done. These have huge implications for the kind of function and the kind of work that it can occur. And through funding support like this that is channeled in these particular ways, through collective agreement, I would argue, through unaddressed power dynamics, institutions are also deeply striated. They are hierarchical. They're not a homogenous whole. There is leadership, and there's folks who work there. There's members who have to access the services. This is not an equal relationship. So when we talk about institutions or organizations, and for those organizations, and we hear some of them these days, thankfully, speaking out, who are outspoken. Quite often those who are outspoken in the context of an organizational structure are doing that as a subcommittee or a group or a separate element of the organizational structure, and that's necessary. Because those who are outspoken and those who address these issues, whether it's relative to the Olympics or any of these broader concerns that I'm talking about, there is controversy and there are threats. And there is always, there's a variety of threats, frankly, but the obvious one is always the dangling carrot of you could lose your funding. And nonprofits, I mean, that's at the end of the day, if you lose your funding, well. So we rely on, what do we rely on? We rely on donations. We rely on donations from with the hope of a generous, public. Quite often working with a model that is absolutely charitable, and that's not a bad thing necessarily, but quite regularly is not political. We rely on, in the context of the Downtown East Side, for example, our organization relies on bigger institutions and organizations, conglomerates, who own property, who rent us property, who are our landlords. We are forced regularly to rely on services and referrals to services that are morally and dogmatically opposed to a feminist anti-colonial stance, for example. And we have to refer folks that we care about to these spaces because there's no other choices. And again, here we are, it's the belly of the beast, but we rely on government funding, and we rely on all levels of government funding, and there are few organizations in the context of social services that don't depend, the majority of their funding doesn't depend on government resources. The removal of funding, that threat, it's not a public and dramatic moment. It can disappear quite quietly. These are matters of often of administration or bureaucracy or budgetary decisions. This is the way of implementing change that is silent and deeply undemocratic. And we can see it modeled all through all levels of government, and particularly the current federal administration. Through a strict rotation of applications, statistics, project reporting, templates, government measures, etc., we are consistently and regularly monitored and observed. And we have very limited support for programming that's continual. That is to say, there is no block funding really anymore. There's no multi-year funding. There used to be. I can think of one exception, but for the most part, there's no multi-year funding. So everything is on a yearly basis. And ultimately, the service of care, and this is a huge industry, the service of care, is defined by the fiscal year. And we should remember that the fiscal year is indeed a construct and an unnatural one and reductive. From every angle, long-term planning is thwarted. There's not a lot of energy for working on the philosophy of an organization or the political voice or even working on internal dynamics in an organization. There's a lack of continuity with an emphasis on project-based mentality. So these one-off sort of what's your new project, get new funding, this kind of thing. It's a real problem in terms of the continuity. And the model there overall reinforces consistently a kind of competition, a competition with peers, with other organizations, people that we all should be working together. Instead, we're having to fight tooth and nail. It's a dismal picture in some ways, I think, if we rely on the support and inevitably feel complicit in reproducing these conditions. And I feel this moment no stronger than the present in the context of the Olympics, when it's been such a grossly, again, inequity in terms of the priorities of economy in the context of this province. And how the silence is deafening, really, in terms of the number of institutions and organizations and groups who haven't made public statements, haven't been present in these conversations. And at the end of the day, we have a bottom line, and it is not an economic one. And our bottom line is the 200 to 350 women and children that walk through our door every day. This is ranging from youth through to very elderly. They are coming in currently active in a struggle against poverty. They are currently dealing with daily conditions of violence. Many of them are very ill. Many of them are in pain. And they're coming into this space, and they need basic necessities. That's the bottom line. The number of people coming into our organization has increased by over 20% since this time last year. That is an unprecedented increase in the number of people. It's overwhelming. Like most organizations, we do not have operational funding. The provincial government was kind enough to take core funding from women's centers away many years ago. We have no funding for food. There is no government funding for food. We have a budget, a very conservative budget of $115,000 plus in-kind resources where we cobble together our food program. We do that on our own. There's no funding for food. In an event of emergency, we do not have the provisions, we do not have water, we do not have the basic necessities to sustain our membership. On a daily basis, we already pay for the filtration of our water because the water quality in the area is not good, and especially for people with multiple health concerns, is actually bad to drink. We have been mandated by our funders on more than one occasion to have emergency preparedness plans in place, to have purchased supplies to respond to the face of epidemics, and we have no resources with which to purchase this. And as we approach the Olympics, to add insult to injury, you know, we're going to have to incur and swallow the costs of increased staffing, because our numbers are going to increase, because the City of Vancouver is advertising its services, is made available in knowledge of what's available. Here's where you can get a free lunch. Because we know there's going to be people in town that's going to need our help. And we know that for our membership, that the crises and the day-to-day issues that they deal with is probably going to be worse. And on top of that, we're going to have thousands of tourists watching us suffer or do our work. And I've been going on about it because I just can't believe it. But we have to accept our food deliveries in the middle of the night between 12 o'clock and 6 o'clock in the morning. So there's a whole new staffing shift that we have to schedule. And so to return again to the folks most impacted, this isn't me. People who are truly the experts in the idea of economy and surviving again in this very difficult, if not failed, economic system. These people, I hate to construct a category of these people, folks are not encouraged to participate in long-term planning. Participation in broader ecological, political, or social movement is consistently undermined. It's not to say it doesn't occur, and that's actually the most impressive thing is the fact that it occurs and it is very strong. With respect to folks who are on the front line of struggles these days, many of the people who are standing up and speaking and risking many things are folks who have survived conditions of poverty or continue to, their families do, their communities do, they've experienced it for generations, centuries. But they're leaders at a cost, as been outlined tonight, and I'm sure we'll talk a bit more about. But the individual cost of policing, of sanctions, public censure, and the health and well-being, the overwhelming stress that what it means to be an organizer at this particular point in time. And so I just want to conclude by saying I think that we are dependent on a sickening system. And I think that moderate reform is insufficient. I think we're in a moment where the concentration of power is in the hands of a head of state, a brutalizing economy for some that is galvanizing the interests of the elite, of the corporate. The austerity measures that we're seeing are leading to an increased economic and sociopolitical marginalization of those most vulnerable. That the enhanced mechanisms of social control and policing are also impacting those most vulnerable. And so if there is a positive legacy, I don't think it's going to be an economic one. But hopefully, And I've already see a broadening of communication and networks, organizing networks, maybe a reimagining of structures of support, new conversations, new people, and generally just a need for the fundamental reimagining of the economics of care.
And that was Cecily Nicholson of the Downtown Eastside Women's Center, and she was speaking 10 days ago at the Right to the City Forum. The forum was hosted by the Impact on Communities Coalition, and the audio you just heard was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and we'd like to thank him very much for doing that recording for us here on Red Eye.